नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स।
It's very good to be here with amongst this harmonious sangha in and this gorgeous California weather. So I'd like to thank everybody for the hospitality that I've been shown, and it's really good to be here. I thought this evening I would talk a little bit about very important spiritual quality, that of upekkha, equanimity. This is one of the really important qualities that is not only something to develop, but it's also, I think, a measure of how well you're doing on the path, how much equanimity you have. And it's important in that it shows up in so many different contexts. It's a bojanga, a factor of awakening. It's a paramita, a perfection. It's brahmavihara, a divine abiding. And it has different applications and different nuances. At its most basic, upekkha is one of the three vedana, one of the three feelings: pleasant feeling, dukkha, or sukha, pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, dukkha, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant, dukkhamasukha, which is also upekkha. That is the most basic form of upekkha, and it's important to know that and recognize it. If pleasant feeling is not clearly known and understood, it leads to craving and desire. If unpleasant feeling is not clearly seen, it leads to aversion. But if neutral feeling is not seen, it leads to confusion and delusion. And I think if you, in this human form of existence, on average, I think if you could possibly keep a running total of mind moments of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, you'd probably find that neutral is the predominant factor. It's where our mind is at rest. It's the natural abiding of the mind, and it's moved to pleasant or unpleasant by stimulus. In terms of ethical qualities, the Abhidhamma tells us that unpleasant feeling is never associated with a skillful mind state. When they correlate, and the Abhidhamma correlates different mental factors, which goes with which. And consciousness moments can be either skillful, kusala, or unskillful, akusala, or there's some other categories, but those are the predominant, the important ones. And dukkha, unpleasant feeling, is never associated with a skillful mind state, which is important, and it's somewhat counterintuitive at first. It just doesn't mean that feeling sadness or grief is bad. It doesn't mean you're an evil person. because you feel sadness or grief. It's natural when there's loss or painful situation that you will feel sadness, but it's not skillful. The Buddha or the Arahants never have a moment of unpleasant feeling. When the Buddha passed away into Parinibbana, we are told that the monks, the bhikkhus who were not yet Arahant, stood weeping and wailing and beating their chest, crying, "Oh, the master is gone. Oh, such loss, the master is gone." But the bhikkhus who were Arahants, they merely nodded their heads and said, "So the master always taught us, that which is subject to arising is subject to ceasing." So neutral feeling or pleasant feeling can be associated with either skillful or unskillful mind states. And pleasant feeling is, in terms of ethical quality, pleasant feeling works as a karma intensifier. That which is done unskillfully, if it's done with relish, then it's worse karma. And if that which is skillful, wholesome, is done with joy, it increases the good karma. So acts of kindness, generosity that are done with joy are more effective, more efficient, produce better karma. So this is the ways the three feelings work in the ethical field. Joy is also classed as one of the factors of awakening, a bojanga. And in that context, equanimity is one of the factors which calms the mind. And joy is one of the factors which energizes the mind. So they're both wholesome, but they have complementary opposite effects on the mind. In general, upekkha is considered to be as a spiritual quality, as a in its higher form, is considered superior or higher than joy or bliss. And this works in the factors of jhana. As the mind develops samadhi and settles deeper into states of jhana, that the passage is always from that which is coarse to that which is subtle. And those are relative terms. That which seems subtle at one stage is perceived as coarse in the succeeding stage. To begin with, the mind that is engaged with the objects of the senses, the ordinary mind, unfocused mind in the world, the experiences of the senses can seem subtle. They can seem enticing, entrancing, and some of the sense experiences are more subtle than others. You think of like the scent of a beautiful flower. It's a subtle sense experience. But when the mind has settled into first jhana, the objects of the senses seem coarse and gross and heavy. Even the most subtle ones are not desired. The nivarana, the obstruction of sense desire, kama tanha, is suppressed in first jhana. The mind doesn't go there. And it's said that sound is a thorn to first jhana, meaning that if sense impressions impinge on the mind, they can pull the mind out of jhana. It's that which has just been left behind. It's not very far away. And the first jhana has the five qualities of the five factors, applied and sustained thought, vitakka vichara, piti, rapture, and sukha, bliss, and ikagata, one-pointedness, to give them their common translations. And second jhana, vitakka vichara, the aspect of mind, seems coarse. Now the sense impressions are far away, and that the application of mind seems coarse and heavy. And the mind naturally gravitates away from that and settles into the remaining factors, piti, sukha, and ikagata. And of the three, in second jhana, piti is predominant. This is a kind of joy or happiness that's thrilling, that the body can experience rushes or tingles or a sense of floating, a lightness, buoyancy. And then that at last comes to seem coarse as well, although it's much more subtle than anything experienced through the senses. It can begin to seem coarse, and the mind settles on, in third jhana, on the factor of sukha, which is, in this context, a peaceful, calm bliss, like oceanic bliss. There's nothing thrilling or moving about it. It's still and calm, but it's blissful. But then, in fourth jhana, and this is the point that I'm leading to, is because bliss is replaced by equanimity, by upeka. So it comes to the point where even bliss seems coarse, and the mind rests in equanimity, which is beyond bliss. It's a deeper settling of the mind. And it's called in one or two places, it's called poetically upeka in this way is called the bliss beyond bliss. And this has a special place in meditative development. And it also represents the passage through the jhanas, is also represents a continual process of not only from the coarse to the subtle, but it also could be described as a purification and a simplification. It's not, and this is a general rule for spiritual practice, is not to be regarded as trying to gain something or attain something or go somewhere. You know, if you think in those kind of terms, you're endlessly going to be caught in this kind of striving mind, and and not escape from the desire mind. It's really about letting go. It's simplifying. It's what factors can you reduce? Can you abandon? And the mind will naturally find the underlying bliss, and then the underlying equanimity. Upeka as a Brahma-vihara, as a four divine abidings. These are, they've been called by some modern commentators, I think quite aptly, they've been called the skillful emotions. Because the wise person always dwells in one of the Brahma-viharas. This is the skillful base of the mind. And the first three, metta, karuna, mudita, they're all variations on a theme. The well-wishing, you know, common translation is loving-kindness, is the wish, the earnest wish that beings be well and happy. So there's an aspiration for beings to be well and happy. Karuna is compassion, is the earnest wish that beings be released from suffering, be freed from suffering. And mudita is sympathetic joy, is the earnest wish that beings may continue to enjoy the good fortune, the happiness that they have found. Upeka, as the fourth, stands apart. It's quite different than the others, and in a way, it's a purification of the others, because it does not involve any kind of aspiration. There's no wish involved with upeka. There's simply a recognition of the universal underlying qualities of that all beings share. It's non-favoritism, non-choosing, non-picking, non-discriminating, just non-judging. Just all beings share the same qualities. Traditional formula is to recognize that all beings are heirs of their karma, all beings are subject to their karma. That can seem a little abstract and a little dry. There is a variation on that I encountered some years ago reading about a talk the Dalai Lama had given someplace, and he was speaking about developing equanimity, and he made the point that equanimity should be developed one being at a time, that there should be a specificity to it, which is an important point. I'll get back to that in another context, but the specificity of developing equanimity, rather than having just a vague all beings are subject to their karma, it's this being is subject to his karma. And that one, and the other. And the second point he made was, he came up with a formula that engages the mind and the heart, I think, a little bit more directly, is this being just wants happiness, doesn't want suffering. And you can apply that to every being. Yeah. Develop it one being at a time. I found sometimes I like to practice this when I'm riding in a car on a busy highway. And I just glance at the faces of the people in the cars coming the other way and think, this being just wants happiness, doesn't want suffering. And there's a universality, you know, you can apply it in those sorts of situations. There's a universality to that contemplation that brings, you know, we're all in this boat together. This samsara has many different variations, many forms, and this even goes beyond the human. It's all forms of beings just want happiness, don't want suffering. Some of them are not very skilled in finding happiness, and they make great suffering for themselves. But the law still applies. They just want happiness. They don't want suffering. So the development of the Brahma Vihara of Upeka is, as I mentioned, it's different than the other three. It transcends them. In a sense, it's a perfection of them, because the other three are still somewhat caught in the sense of persons, of beings. It doesn't really they don't really open up directly to the sense of anatta or not self, whereas upeka can open in that way. It goes beyond the sense it cuts out any sense of aspiration or desire or discontent. It's just complete acceptance or recognition of all beings. This quality of the Brahma-Vihara of upeka is recognized in the Visuddhimagga as being separate from the other three, in that it's in that text, which is the classic Theravada meditation manual written by Buddha Gosa about 1,000 years after the Buddha's time. And it's a very important text in Theravada tradition. He recommends not practicing upeka until one has mastered, meaning being able to enter jhana on one of the other three. So he treats it as a kind of a graduate course in Brahma-Viharas. You first have to finish your baccalaureate in metta or karuna or mudita before you can take up upeka. You can benefit greatly by developing upeka at any time. Visuddhimagga does tend to be kind of formulistic. We have to be flexible with the practice. Upeka as a Brahma-Vihara is the sense of equanimity of persons. But that is still not the... or equanimity of beings would probably be a better phrase. But it's still not... the highest form of upeka. What is cuts even deeper is upeka towards dhammas, towards mind objects, or towards phenomena. That which arises in the mind is a dhamma. So everything in the universe is essentially a dhamma as soon as we put our attention on it. Upeka towards dhammas is the essence of developing vipassana. And the quality of mind has this quality of mind of upeka towards dhammas has a special name in Pali that's quite neat. It's tatramajjatata. It's translated accurately, but not actually quite literally by Bhikkhu Bodhi and others as specific neutrality. That's quite good. That's what it is, a specific neutrality. But if you look at the roots of the word, a more direct literal translation would be being in the middle about that. Tatra is that. Yeah. And so that's the specific aspect. It's not just being in the middle in a general, fuzzy, vague way. It's being specifically in the middle about that. And what is that? That is whatever object is arising to the conscious mind at this moment. So when you develop this form of equanimity, the specific neutrality, this middleness about that, there's a great fluidity in the mind. There's a great freedom. Objects arise to the mind, and the mind is simply aware of them without grasping, without identification, without holding or clutching. without picking or choosing, without wanting or without fear or aversion. It's simply that, and I'm in the middle about it. I'm not taking a position. And that specificity is very important. It's possible to have a state of mind of a vague feeling of general awareness without noticing anything in particular. And I think that's very often when people say they're practicing choiceless awareness, often they fall into that kind of a space. And it can feel pleasant and it can feel like you're meditating, but you're not really going anywhere because you're not really penetrating the nature of reality. And just as equanimity, just as the Dalai Lama said that equanimity towards persons is best developed one person at a time, equanimity of dhammas is best developed one dhamma at a time. Whatever arises to consciousness at this moment, if you're practicing vipassana, if you're trying to penetrate the nature of reality, whatever arises at the mind at this moment, that's the correct object of meditation. And you need to be in the middle about that. When you develop this kind of looking, this special clear seeing, which we call vipassana, which is more a way of holding the mind than in a specific technique. You know, there are techniques for developing it, but the actual experience of vipassana is clear seeing. It's a particular way of holding the mind. The mind developing that practice goes through a number of stages, and this has been written up in great detail by many meditation masters and scholars, beginning with Buddhaghosa. The Visuddhimagga is structured on the stages of insight. The chapters follow the stages of insight. A more modern example is Mahasi Sayadaw of Burma, a great meditation master who's written in very technical detail about the stages of insight. And when the mind goes through these various stages, eventually it reaches a stage which is called equanimity about formations. And here we have upekkha again, sankhara upekkha, equanimity about formations. And this stage is a critical. It can be considered the jumping off place. It's not yet awakening, but it's the only state of mind from which awakening is possible. The process of samsara continues in this stage, but now one is in the middle about it. Reduced to its most fundamental description, samsara is the process of the mind grasping an object. At each moment, the unawakened mind is consumed with desire for objects. And samsara being what it is, the objects fail to satisfy. So the mind is then reaching out for the next one. This is the primordial addiction. This is the process that's been going on since beginningless time. When the objects, the dhammas, are seen with the eye of wisdom, with clear seeing, they're seen as having the three characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta: impermanence, unsatisfactoriness and not self. Samsara can be likened to a kaleidoscope. As children's toy that looks like a telescope, it has mirrors in it and little bits of colored glass. And you turn the wheel and you see different beautiful mandalas, patterns. And samsara is experienced by the beings in its midst as something very complex and manifold and various and beautiful and wonderful and terrifying. It alternately entices and excites and terrifies and horrifies. But it all seems so vital and real and impossible to put down, the telescope, the kaleidoscope. But all it is three pieces of colored glass, anicca, dukkha, and anatta, being reflected in various combinations. And those qualities apply to every single Dhamma that arises in the conditioned mind, in the conditioned world. And from the position of equanimity about formations, when the mind is really practicing tatra majjatatta, being in the middle about that, this process of objects arising continues, but the mind is not gripping them. So the stickiness of samsara is wearing out. Instead of being excited and enchanted or terrified, the mind is simply, oh, that's another one. Oh, there's another one. The Vasuddhimagga uses some really good analogies for this state of mind. One of them is sailors on a ship, on a voyage. In olden times, they would always keep a bird, a crow, in a cage on the deck. And when they thought they might be near land, they would let the crow out of the cage. And they called them the land-finding crow. And the crow would fly out to the north, and if he didn't find anywhere to perch, he would come back to the ship. And he would rest for a while, then he would fly out again to the east. He'd come back to the ship. And if they were anywhere near land, the crow didn't come back. And they knew that direction, there was land. And he says that the mind, Buddha Ghosa says, the mind in equanimity of formations is like this. It endlessly goes out. And it comes back. But eventually it might find the other shore. It doesn't come back. In slightly more technical language, the same text says, describes it this way. It says that and then it comes to pass that the mind does that which it has not done since beginningless time and alights upon non-occurrence. And the only way that's possible is because occurrence is no longer being clung to, grasped. And that comes from being equanimous, from having upekkha. So there's a striking parallelism here in the in these various practices, in the samatha path, in the samadhi path, the perfection of that path in fourth jhana is based on equanimity. In the Brahmaviharas, the highest Brahmavihara is equanimity. And in the insight path, the state to be reached is equanimity about formations. And that is, in a sense, it's not, that in itself, equanimity of formations is not, as I said, awakening or liberation in itself, but it's really the last place you can go to. You can't really do anything. You know, you go there, you work like the Dickens to get there, and then you just sit there, you know, and let it unfold. So it's a upekkha, to summarize the essential point. The upekkha is a spiritual quality to be developed in many ways and in daily life and in meditation practice. And it's also a measure, a touchstone of how well you are progressing. How much equanimity do you have? And this is a good self-test. How easily do I fall into extreme emotional reactions? Am I capable of being equanimous? Am I capable of dealing with life's vicissitudes in a sane, calm, reasoned way? Can I be in the middle about that? I'll just offer these reflections for you this evening. So.